Well, it seems undeniable over the past 48 hours, Russia has launched a rather large, if you want to say massive, offensive in the northern part of the country. And this is the, maybe this is the spring offensive we've been hearing so much about now that the ground has firmed up. We are also hearing reports of widespread Ukrainian surrenders. Is this a new trend? Is the message getting out that they will either be able to surrender and live a peaceful life eventually or be slaughtered on the battlefield? We're also hearing, of course, that NATO seems to be ramping up once again, beating the drums of war, with Germany and the UK and France pointing towards perhaps NATO involvement in this war. So much to talk about and a big shakeup internally inside of Russia. We thought, who better to ask than Alexander Makuras from the Duran, kind enough to join us today from London with his brilliant assessments, as always, about military strategy and geopolitics. Alexander, great to see you. Welcome back to the show.
I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. So first, I guess let's start with this offensive. The Western media has been silent on it, not surprisingly. Nothing really in the United States to talk about a Russian offensive, but it appears that maybe not a full-scale spring offensive, but maybe a large one nonetheless. What do you know about what we're seeing with the Russian forces in the north?
Well, as you correctly said, there's a lot of fog of war. But the impression I've had is that over the first couple of days, the immediate period that you've been mentioning, the last 48 hours, we've not yet seen the Russians commit their main army, their main forces. Apparently, this was an advance by relatively lightly equipped infantry troops crossing the frontier into Ukraine. And what happened was that even as these infantry advanced, the Russian Air Force has been very active, lots of drones, lots of artillery strikes, and the Ukrainian defenses collapsed. It was much more unexpected by the Ukrainians themselves, and I think by the Russians. But a string of villages falling one after the other, tumbling one after the other into Russian hands. No sign of an organized Ukrainian defense, no sign of minefields or fortified lines about which we've been hearing so much. The Ukrainians have now sacked the general who was in charge. There's reports that the Ukrainian leadership are in recriminations with each other. The intelligence chief, a man called Budanov, is saying that it's all the fault of the military chief, Sirsky, that this thing has gone as badly as it has. And there's lots of reports that the Ukrainians, facing what is looking like a debacle on their northern borders, and unsure how far the Russians intend to go, are now pulling in troops from every single part of their front lines, weakening their front lines even further. Now, for me, what this shows is the fragility that Ukraine has reached at this point in the war. A relatively limited offensive by the Russians, but an unexpected one, or at least it shouldn't have been unexpected because it's been much talked about, but a new offensive that they weren't really prepared for. And it's creating a crisis right across the entire Ukrainian battlefronts. And that tells you that Ukraine, at least tells me, that Ukraine is literally at the end of its resources. It's like it's trying to hold back the flood. It's trying to plug the holes in the dike as the flood comes in, and there are more and more holes springing in, and they're finding it more and more difficult to do.
I guess it's a two-pronged question here, because it seems like then NATO, this is a desperate moment here for NATO. They will either have to throw in the towel, walk home with their tail between their legs, or commit to something perhaps larger. We've already seen that weapons don't seem to be enough. Now you're going to have to put some sort of boots on the ground. We heard from the Russian ambassador who spoke to Member of Parliament Andrew Bridgen in your neck of the woods, who said, and he told him flat out, we know that Ukrainians aren't firing these missiles. You, the British, are there firing these at this. And we know, and we are at war with you. So now, I guess it's up to NATO. How large do you want to go here?
I don't think that the NATO people themselves know, and I think they're very divided about this. I don't think they ever expected, in their darkest nightmares a year ago, that they would be in this situation. A year ago, they were talking about the Ukrainian offensive, and they were expecting that Russia would be defeated. And a year before, they'd been confident that the sanctions would have their effect. So they find themselves in a situation of impending disaster. And of course, it's a disaster they've brought on themselves, because they've so invested in Ukraine. They've put so much of their own credibility on the line in Ukraine that if Ukraine falls and goes under, inevitably that credibility is going to be badly damaged. Now, they all know that. They don't have a simple answer to this. They know that whatever weapons they send to Ukraine is never going to be enough. They know that Ukraine's manpower problems are becoming impossible. So what do they do? They can talk to the Russians, but there are enormous political obstacles in the face of doing that. And it would be deeply humiliating, and it would reverse the entire course of Western policy. Or alternatively, they can escalate by sending in troops and taking on incredible risks and perhaps provoking a big popular reaction in Europe and perhaps in the United States. Or they can do nothing, hope that something turns up, and if Ukraine goes down, we'll hope that the damage to their credibility can be limited in some way. So, not an attractive series of options. But it is unsurprising, maybe, that some people are talking about escalation, given how bad the situation is.
Yeah, can you imagine? Not, as you point out, not in their darkest nightmares did they anticipate over 600,000 dead, over a million casualties on the Ukrainian side, that this would be just a, I guess, a fountain of eternal human beings and resources that NATO could use over and over and over again if we just kept supplying them with weapons. Little did they realize they would wipe out an entire generation or two of Ukrainian men. To your point, who are they going to throw at this? Now we're hearing, of course, over the past 24 hours, Germany has now stepped up, lowering their conscription standards to 18 years old, and they're not going to care which gender you are. So 18 years old to go on a war footing, the UK as well. France, Macron going back and forth. And again, over the weekend saying he hopes we don't have to commit troops. So to your point, it seems like NATO is all over the map right now. It doesn't really have a clear sense of what they want.
No, they don't. And I mean, in Germany, this is going to be very unpopular, reintroducing conscription shortly after, a couple of years after it was ended. Major demand in Germany to end conscription. And now they're talking of bringing it back. But that will be controversial, but it can probably just about stick. But not if German soldiers are going to be sent to fight Russia and Ukraine. I mean, that will not be acceptable to the German public at all. You're going to get major protests in Germany if anything like that happens. So, but what they have done is exactly the opposite of what they were trying to do when this conflict began. The whole plan was to weaken Russia, to make Russia weaker militarily, to destabilize its economy, to somehow separate, isolate it from the rest of the world. Everything has turned out otherwise. Russia is militarily much more powerful. Its army is bigger. It's also much more efficient than it used to be. It's outproducing the West in weapons. It is very angry with the West, indeed, which is unsurprising, but it is. And perhaps Western leaders think that it's even angrier than it actually is, in fact. But that's another story.
Right.
And of course, it's not politically isolated in the world. It's got strong friendships with China and India, and the West has tried to undermine those, and it hasn't worked. And the economy is stable as well. So what they have done is that they have taken steps which have made the reality of the Russian threat real which it had no reality before. They've achieved the exact opposite of what they expected. And of course, now they're rushing and they're coming up and they're saying, we've got to do something because the Russians are coming. We've got to build up our forces again. We've got to rearm, we've got to rebuild, we've got to do all of these things. But doing such things would require major revolutionary transformations in Western societies, European societies, which I'm far from convinced the governments in the West understand and would know how to manage, and which I also strongly suspect Western publics would not be keen on at all. Remilitarization of Western societies is going to be extremely difficult to do now.
I hope you're right about that. I hope you're right. But we've got some crazy leaders that don't really care what we think at the end of the day, sadly. Just look at the United States right now. I'll get you out of here on this, Alexander, which is the number of surrenders that we're seeing. You know, you're not, again, hearing this in the Western media, the number of Ukrainian men who are surrendering. As you pointed out, Russian forces are finding basically no defense at all when they've been entering these villages. And from the reports I've seen, we're seeing a lot of Ukrainian men just surrendering. They're getting these messages, I guess. I don't know exactly how they're reaching the, or how they're delivering these messages from the Russian side. Like, lay down your arms. You don't need to die in this conflict. You can just surrender. What do you know about the number of surrenders? Are we seeing more now, do you think, than we were seeing months ago?
Yes. I mean, it's been a steadily rising trend for several months. Now, it's not yet reached critical levels. We're not seeing whole units, you know, lay down their arms and surrender, but we're seeing large groups of soldiers starting to surrender. And on the first day, apparently around 50 men, Ukrainian troops laid down their arms and surrendered. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but in the context of this war, it is. And it's another sign of the general war weariness and demoralization that is starting to take hold in Ukraine. There was an article in the London Times when they were interviewing a Ukrainian soldier, and they asked him, this is the London Times, do you think this war will end in victory? And he simply said, no, Ukraine is going to lose. And that was a Ukrainian soldier in, you know, the military, under military discipline, speaking to a Western media channel, you know, a major Western media outlet. So, I mean, I think you're getting more and more of that sense right across Ukraine now, that the war is lost, that there are politicians in Kiev who don't understand it, but that's inevitable now.
I did say I was going to get you out of here a second ago. I have to ask you about Shoigu, of course.
Yeah.
The shakeup over the weekend we learned inside of the Russian military. Apparently, he's now going to be, I think, in charge of national security, removed from his position. Is this a big deal, or is this an affirmation that Putin won an election and a landslide? He has the mandate of the people to do what he wants. Do you see a shift in military strategy with this move?
I think there is a shift, actually, though the point about a mandate is a good one. First of all, it is not a demotion of Shoigu. I mean, he's been appointed to a very senior position, one which nominally is higher than the one he previously occupied.
Interesting.
Secretary of the Security Council is a very senior position indeed in Russia. But he's also been given, and this has not been reported in the West, you have to go to the official Russian news agency TASS to see this. He's been given a whole set of new responsibilities as Secretary of the Security Council, which his predecessor in that role did not have, which basically puts Shoigu in overall charge of the Russian military industrial complex and gives him responsibility for weapons development. Now, this isn't, as I said, something that people in the West are aware of. But what I think Putin has done is he's taken Shoigu, who's a trained engineer and a very experienced and very capable manager, and who's recently been touring the factories and making sure the production of weapons increases. He's basically freed him from the responsibility of the administrative burdens in the defense ministry and given him this job of basically supervising the military industrial complex. So it's an important role, and it also means that he's now very close to Putin as national security advisor. He's Putin's effective national security advisor as well. So it's a sort of sideways shift, but an important one. Whilst the person who's taking over from him in the defense ministry, who's a man called Belousov, is a very, very experienced Soviet era economic technocrat who works in, whose background basically is in long range planning, who was running the overall Russian economy until a few days ago. He's apparently a very well regarded figure. And I think his job is now that military production and spending within the defense ministry has increased to such an extent to make sure that this is streamlined and is actually going where it's needed rather than, you know, on fancy projects or other things. So it's an interesting set of decisions. But as I said, not one that I think has been well understood in the West.
No, I think you're right about that. I think it's Putin fires his, you know, top guy. Does this mean that they're losing the war? You know, those are the types of headlines you'll see in the West, of course. So it's actually a promotion, and he actually has a much bigger job now ahead of him as NATO is trying to find out how they can throw everything they can at their military-industrial complex right now. Alexander, great to see you. Where can people find your work? I mean, I follow you on multiple fronts. But where can people follow you?
Well, I have my YouTube channel, Alexander Mercuris, which you can find on YouTube and on all kinds of other platforms, BitChute, Odyssey, wherever. I also, of course, work on the Duran with my colleague and friend, Alex Cristoforo. We got our channel, The Duran, on YouTube. And we can also find me on Locals, where I'm also present, but that's as part of The Duran. You can find all my videos there. So type in my name in YouTube and you'll come to me, and you'll come to all of these other places also.
Perfect. Well, must watch content all the time. Alexander, great to have you here. Thank you for your expertise as always, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Clayton. Thank you for the invitation.
I really hope you enjoyed watching this video. You know, YouTube thinks that you'll actually like this next video right here. It's personalized based on your own viewing habits. So if you watch the video, please leave a comment. Let us know what you think about it, and we will see you next time, everyone.